tonight on Arena. Denise Mina on being commissioned to write a new Philip Marlowe mystery, and new albums from Rita Ora, Mahalia and Sam Burton up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Down those mean streets a man must go who is not himself mean, so wrote Raymond Chandler of his iconic private eye, Philip Marlowe. Now, with a new novel, The Second Murderer, we get a female PI walking those streets with Marlowe. And it's one of the leading lights of Tartan Noir, the award-winning Denise Mina, who is the writer commissioned to give us this new Philip Marlowe mystery. And delighted to have Denise join us on the programme this evening. 14 crime novels of your own, Denise. We can go back to the award-winning debut, Garnet Hill, in 1988. There have been lots of award winners since that as well. There are short stories, there are plays, there are graphic novels. What was the attraction of Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe for you?
Oh, you know, I've always been such a fan of Raymond Chandler. What I really love is that people would quote the way he had written lines rather than tell you the plot. And I think that's the real magic. Do you know what I mean? That's like why most people read him is for the writing and not for the story, which I think is kind of beautiful.
Yeah, guilty as charged. The way
do
I just.
Do you know what I mean? Everyone's. What's your favourite Raymond Chandler quote?
Yeah, well, I must say, I did use one of my favourites at the very top of the item, down those mean streets. Right. A man must go who is not himself mean. Do you have a favourite?
Well, I suppose the most famous would be, you know, she had the kind of face that would make a bishop kick in a stained glass window. Something a lot. I'm not doing it justice there. But it's just these little similes. And I don't know if people know that he was at the same school as P.G. Woodhouse. And they had the same English master. And they both used similes the same way. So I think this master must have got kids to do competitions or something like that. Because, you know, P.G. Woodhouse would say things like, I legged it like a nymph surprised while bathing. He's very quotable in that area as well. But anyway, I really love Chandler. And like you're saying, you know, one of the things that I really loved about him was he had blue-collar central characters who had tremendous integrity. And they didn't, you know, they had their own value system. And I think when you're writing detective novels, really, what the audience are not there to find out who the murderer is usually. They're usually there to spend time with the detective. Mm. And that's what he did so well, you know, is that you want to be in every scene with Marlowe. I nearly bit their hand off when they asked me to do that.
Yeah, I can imagine. And particularly for a crime writer who's a fan of Chandler, what else could you do? But is there some kind of a, you know, giant on my shoulder feel as you take up his character? And obviously you have to be somehow loyal to that character and to Chandler himself, but you also have to be loyal to Denise Mina. Probably more important that you're loyal to her.
Well, it's such an interesting proposition, these estate books, because what are you doing? Are you cosplaying Chandler? Are you channeling the voice of Philip Marlowe? Are you telling that story from now? I mean, there are lots of different choices you have to make right at the very beginning. But because I'm a Chandler fan, I didn't want to let other people who are Chandler fans down by just making it Denise Mina redoes this. So I actually did things like, you know, I did a drawing of his sentence structure on different pages to see how short and long they were, what sort of pattern they followed. Because as a reader, that's very important to me. And, you know, I mean, I really wanted to do him justice because he is a man of his time. So there are no real women in there. I mean, I wanted to write female characters in Chandler's world who had ambitions beyond getting a boyfriend, which is really what all the women seem to want to do, is get a boyfriend. And, you know, as a 50-year-old woman, you know, there are other things.
There are other things in life, yes.
Don't get me wrong, boyfriends are great, but, you know, there are other things, like making a living.
And I mean, because in some ways, the plot of The Second Murderer has lots of Chandlerian, if that's an adjective, tropes within it. We have a missing young woman, Chrissy Montgomery, who, by the way, I love the fact that spoken one accent, Chrissy Montgomery could quite definitely be from the mean streets of Glasgow, but in this case, she's from 1940s LA. She has a dying father, Chadwick Montgomery, very wealthy, who has a relationship with his bottle blonde secretary, Annalise Lyle. Those things are kind of all part of the Chandler world. What isn't part of the Chandler world is Anne Reardon, the head of an all-female detective agency who has some kind of a history with Marlowe and who's actually going to help him out in this, in solving this particular case. That was something that obviously you wanted to get in there.
Well, you know, in this, in Farewell, My Lovely, Anne Reardon saves Marlowe several times and she actually asks if she can work with him. Mm. And he says, no, I like working on my own, which is fair play. But so in this book, she has gone on and set up her own detective agency. She's a brilliant character. In Farewell, My Lovely, whenever you're reading that book, you always want her to appear because she's a voice. She is a sounding board for him to explain what's going on. But she's also, she's very cool. She's independently wealthy. She's a contemporary of his. And I always felt that there was a, you know, a wee yearning between them. And and he never really has a relationship. And I felt like this was something that was really lacking in Marlowe. It's not that he has a relationship, settles down, but it's that he really wants to connect with other people very clearly as a character. And I just thought, you know, for him to have a contemporary who was a female and that there was a connection between them would be lovely.
So you invented this other life for her where, well, this, not other life, but you took
Afterlife.
Her from, you took her from something that was happening outside of the Chandler books in another world.
Yeah.
And here she is as the head of this all-female, and it's an all-female detective agency, including the PIs and everybody who works in the office as well. What does she, you talked about her being a kind of a sounding board for Marlowe, because he talks to us, the reader, very directly, obviously, when he's narrating the books, Marlowe does. What does Anne Reardon provide him with beyond that sounding board aspect? Does she make him have to think about who he is and what he's doing and aspects of his life?
She makes him, you know, wonder about the future. I mean, one of the really lovely things I think about Marlowe is that he is a man walking on his own. But at the same time, he does connect really quite intensely with characters, like in The Big Sleep and with Lennox. He connects very intensely and he's a very loyal friend. But, you know, I think she really makes him think about his life out with his work, which is very much what's missing, because he is just staggering from rented apartment to rented apartment in most of the books.
Yeah, so it is about maybe he has to think that there's something in life outside of this PI stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, and he imagines a different future for himself, I think.
Yeah. How different for you were the mean streets of LA 1940, which is where you set the book, or the 1940s in and around that period, and contemporary Glasgow, which is where your novels are normally set? Were there meeting points there that you could tap into?
Well, all cities are the same. And, you know, the thing about LA in 1940 was LA was just about to undergo massive changes. So it's as available to people who live in LA as to me, actually. And it's very well documented. So I didn't feel hard to get hold of. The thing that you have to get your head around was how unpopulated it was and how white. I mean, Sunset Boulevard was basically a bridle path at that point. Everywhere beyond that, north of that, had a stables because it was where the movie stars lived. They all went horse riding. So it was a very, very different city. And I think it would have been about the size of Glasgow. So kind of Glasgow without the rain and the fighting. The last time.
Yeah. The other aspect that you bring into it, and you bring it I'm using the word disturbing, that's not quite the right word, but in a way that is certainly thought-provoking and upsetting to read at times, domestic violence is it's right throughout the novel, in fact, throughout The Second Murderer. Just talk to me a little bit about how you wanted to portray that within this 1940s world and why it was important to do so.
Because, you know, we now think there is a kind of consensus of opinion that it's bad, but at that time it wasn't. I mean, within living memory, I mean, when I was growing up, people would hit each other, you know, women would get battered and everybody would just say, oh, it's nothing to do with us. So at that time, I don't think people even really hid it very much. And it's the whole thing about the income differentials, because there are very poor people and very rich people in LA at that time, is power. And I think domestic violence and mistreating others within your power to do is a really significant metaphor for the power struggles that are going on all over Los Angeles at the time. Money was flooding down from Chicago from the mob, and it was corrupting absolutely everything in Chicago at that time.
But as the novel progresses, because it is all about the search for this Chrissy Montgomery character, that's kind of central to the plot of the piece. But as you say, it's more about what happens on the way to all of that and solving whatever it is that has to be solved. That's only part of the story here. It's the journey to it. And you journey us from the wonderful wealth of Chadwick Montgomery and his house up in Beverly Hills right down through the streets of LA, down to Skid Row itself. That obviously that economic aspect was important to you, was it?
Very, and I think, you know, Skid Row is such a significant place in the heartland of America right now because it is absolutely, they've got like 40,000 homeless people in LA at the moment. And, you know, these are dentists who got cancer. This is like ordinary people because the housing crisis is so bad. But actually, the story at the centre of it is about an artistic estate, which I wanted to put in there because it is an estate book. And I think when I read estate books, the pending question, the hanging question is always, how did this happen? How did this numpty from Glasgow get to write a Raymond Chandler book? I think that's so interesting. Do you know what I mean? What happened to the ownership of the intellectual property in that? So the central story is about the ownership of art.
Yeah. Talk to us a little, because it is an important part of the plot, as you say, this artist and the value that's put on his work. How much do you want to tell us about what he does along the way in order to increase the value of his work?
Well, he's a very important, he has a very big exhibition in an art gallery, which is basically Peggy Guggenheim bought a lot of art just as war was breaking out in Europe, brought it over to America and sold it for a fortune. And these were like house, it was like Picasso, these people. Really, she made people's reputations at the time. And she bought all that stuff because people were basically just fleeing the Nazis. She brought it over here and introduced to everyone in America. And interestingly, she was actually in competition with her uncle, Solomon Guggenheim, who had very sort of classical tastes. So he sets up the Guggenheim Museum, which is, you know, it ends in like 1910, and she sets up this modernist thing. And the value of those artistic works is contingent on the reputation of the artists not being sullied by, for example, being a Nazi. So it becomes, you know, people are desperate for the value to accrue to these artworks, and they want to manage the reputation of the artist at the same time.
And to what extent were you, you know, I know inevitably, I've said this a million times, when you're writing about an historical period, of course you're writing about today as well. How conscious were you of making some sort of comment on the contemporary art world in that respect?
Well, I mean, I think that is just so interesting. You know, we have the Banksy exhibition here on in Glasgow at the moment, and it talks directly about the monetization of art and the purpose of art. And, you know, I mean, I think that's very important, you know, that the market has taken over the ascription of value in visual arts very much so. And, you know, it's always like this will be a good investment, and actually that's not really what art's about. Street art directly challenges that. So I was very, very aware of thinking about that and how problematic all of that is. And then I'm a commercial writer, because if you're a crime writer, you are selling jam, and you do want to sell your jam to people, or they won't read it, you know? Do you know what I mean? And, you know, it's not like maybe writing poetry where you have an eye on, you know, history. You're really trying to speak to now at the same time. So very conscious of it.
So is that you? Are you saying in some ways, are you removing your writing from that art aspect then by saying it's jam?
Well, no, I think the high art, low art distinction is nonsense. And, you know, I write comic books as well. And over the 20 years that I've been writing comic books, it's gone from being people perceived as an aid to literacy for people who can't read to being a high art form. Because the movies made money. And so you realise how, you know, how these things change all the time, like the distinction between high art and low art. It's absolutely meaningless, class-based nonsense for my money. You know, I mean, I can get as much out of an article in Take a Break as I can out of a beautiful piece of poetry, because, you know, the reader does so much of it. Do you know what I mean? But I think if you're working in a commercial sphere, there is an understanding with the publisher that you will try and sell your jam, whereas you can just flick your cape and look away if you're writing in other areas. But, you know, I think that all comes from Byron, because Byron didn't need the money. So there is this myth that we're all, you know, independently wealthy, but you know, most writers aren't.
Not at all. Anne Reardon, the character, is there more in her from you, Denise?
Oh, do you know, I'd love to do that. I would absolutely love to do that.
Because that agency, and that agency that you've set up for her is astonishing. I mean, there's a lot to be had out of that. Are you tempted? Can you take her and move away with her like that?
Oh, can I? I don't know. I mean, I really want to, but you know, there may be another Chandler book, or there may be an Anne Reardon standalone. But I think these things are all tied up in copyright, and it's quite complicated, and you have to make sure it's all right with everybody before you can do that. I wrote a history book called Rizzio, which was part of a rewriting of Scottish history, or a fictionalised rewriting of Scottish history. And then I was asked to do another one, but of course I couldn't do another one because everybody else, all the other writers were doing Scotland, and I would look like an attention seeker, and as if I'd stolen the idea. So I had to, I've got one out just now, and it's about Savonarola. It's called Three Fires. So there's a way of shifting that, do you know what I mean? Like, you don't have to do the same thing again, you know?
Yeah, there may be other ways around it. I get the sense that you enjoyed yourself doing this, and I hope you get a chance to enjoy yourself in some other way in and around the same area very soon, Denise. Thanks so much for speaking with us this evening.
I'm delighted. Thank you for having me.
That's not at all. That's Denise Mina there, and her book, The Second Murderer, is published by Harville Secker. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. 50 years ago this week, the world was introduced to the band Queen and their self-titled debut album. Having initially been turned down by other record companies, EMI took a chance and released it. Despite not being an immediate success, this album set them on a course that saw them fill stadiums and sell 300 million records worldwide. To coincide with the anniversary, and with the help of Pat Carty, we look at the birth of the band and trace their path to stardom. Just go back to that first iteration, if you would, first of all, Pat, of Queen. An outfit, in fact, called Smile. Who was involved there and when did they form?
Right, well, it's Brian May, first of all, who was in college studying physics and infrared astronomy. So we know this is a smart fella. I think he was working as a part-time teacher as well, just to make ends meet. So he was in Smile with a fella called Tim Staffel. And they didn't have a drummer, so they put an ad up. And a dentistry student, Mr. Roger Taylor, that's the good-looking one out of Queen that people will know. He turns up with his set of drums, so he's in. And they were going along doing okay, but Tim had a pal called Farouk Bulsara, who was an immigrant from Zanzibar, and he was studying fashion design, which might be appropriate. Mm. And then he switched to graphic design, and he was hanging around the band, you know, and the story goes that he roadied for them. But I think what that really meant was he carried the odd drumstick maybe into a gig or something like that. And he spent a lot of time at the side of the stage, basically telling them where they were going wrong and saying, well, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. And then when Staffel got an offer from some other band to leave, he campaigned with May and Taylor and said, look, I can do this, I can sing. And so they let him in, and it was Bulsara then who suggested that they change the name from Smile to Queen.
Yeah.
Because himself and Taylor had a secondhand clothes stall in Covent Garden, which they were using to make ends meet. And apparently the people they hung around with were, shall we say, a bit flamboyant. So that's where the name comes from, apparently.
And for those who don't know, Farouk Bulsara didn't stay too long with that name either.
No, he didn't. There's an early song by Queen which is on this album called My Fairy King, and My Fairy King, the title will tell you where people's heads were around 1973.
Yeah.
And there's a line in it that says, Mother Mercury, look what you've done to me. So Farouk was changed to Freddie, which was his nickname anyway, and he took the second name Mercury from there. And there you go, Sean, there's history starting there.
So Queen and Freddie Mercury, the two names were born in and around the same time. Was there ever a frontman? I mean, it's extraordinary that he kind of had to find his way to being the frontman in the band. Has there been a frontman who can kind of put any competition up to Freddie Mercury? He was something really that we hadn't seen before, and one could argue we haven't seen the likes of since.
Yeah, I don't. That's a very good question. I mean, obviously there's lots of great front men and people in rock and roll, but Freddie. I mean, I tell you, like, even when Freddie had passed away, Queen came to town here. It's not that long ago. 2018, I'm not sure exactly when, what was left of Queen, let's put it that way. Mm. And they had Adam Lambert singing, and Adam Lambert was the runner-up in American Idol or something. And they did a gig out in Marley Park, and it was fantastic. Don't get me wrong, it was absolutely brilliant. And Lambert was great value. As flamboyant as you like, the kind of fella you could imagine maybe getting a late night phone call from Liberace saying maybe you should tone it down a small bit, Adam, that kind of fella. And but at the end of it, when they'd gone off stage before the encore, a video came up of Freddie doing the AO thing, if you know what I'm talking about there, where he leads the crowd. He did it at Live Aid as well, and it was so effective. You know, people were in tears, and he wasn't even there. That's how good he was.
Yeah. No, there was something particularly special about him that I don't think many people would argue with that. The album, the self-titled album that we're celebrating 50 years ago this week, that we're celebrating this evening on Arena, it opens with a track called Keep Yourself Alive. I'll set it going in a minute, but really, big long introductions here, but a lot of it showing off the wonderful guitar playing of Brian May.
Yeah, that's all across that album. He really is an amazing player. I mean, one of the producers, Roy Thomas Baker, referred to his instrument as an orchestral instrument rather than a rock and roll instrument, because he adds such different textures to the songs. And on the album, and on many Queen albums that followed, there's a legend printed, nobody played synthesizers, because May was very concerned that people would think that he was using a synthesizer when he was really just using different treatments on the guitar. And it's really, you know, we talk about this album, and it's not the greatest album of all time, let's be honest, but everything that would come along later on is already there, and you can hear it in this song, I think.
Yourself Alive, there, the opening track on the self-titled album of Queen, an album that was released 50 years ago this week. Pat Carty helping me celebrate that. We talked a little bit about the, you know, and even in the introduction to Keep Yourself Alive, the guitar playing of Brian May, and it comes back in again into the song later, that kind of, I don't know what he's doing that isn't synthesized, but that wonderful kind of flangey type of sound that he gets in the introduction. But then in arrive those vocals of Freddie Mercury. It really does, it lays out the stall of what Queen were going to become in later years.
Yeah, it does, really. I mean, there was interviews with May and Taylor about that time, about Smile, when Freddie was trying to join the band. And they always say, oh, he had a very squeaky voice and it wasn't great. So I don't know what happened. But by the time they got in to do this in the studio, I mean, he was fully formed. And really, the people who were around them who had seen these gigs. Now, they did, like every band, they played gigs where maybe six men and a dog turned up and things like that. But people who did see them said, you know, once they had the four of them in place, so they'd hired John Deacon on bass as well before they started recording this. So the four members were in place, that they really were a force to be reckoned with. Just the public, they just had to wait for the public to catch on, I suppose.
Yeah, and John Deacon on bass, Roger Taylor, as you had said earlier, on drums. And while the No Synths label was always there on the Queen albums, the other thing was Roger Taylor was always very keen to point out that these were acoustic drums. There wasn't a drum machine in sight.
Well, I don't know. Was there a drum machine in existence at that time? We're talking about 50 years ago. But definitely not. Definitely not. This is a band that learned how to play the hard way, you know, by going around and playing, as I say, these gigs where there was nobody and more people on stage than there was in the audience, that kind of thing. So they'd learned their trade. Also, around this time, or maybe it's just after it, they got a support gig with Mott the Hoople, and played up and down the UK. And then Mott took them to the US as well. So that helped them break them there, you know. So they put the work in. They may have been educated, slightly posh boys, but they put the work in. Mm.
It is a bit of a mixed bag, the album, but there are some absolutely astonishing tracks on it. And again, really, it's the tracks that kind of show us what was to come. Let's have a listen to Liar. Once again, very big, long introduction on this, but it's when it gets into the chorus, I think, that we hear certain aspects of a very famous song of Queen's that were to come later on. But let's listen to Liar first of all. There we have have the track Liar from Queen's self-titled debut album released 50 years ago this week. And Pat Carty, it's when you hear the harmonies on Liar, it's impossible not to hear the beginnings of Bohemian Rhapsody there, isn't it?
Well, I think so. Also, we should note as well, they take their time getting to the chorus. They're not in any huge hurry to get there. But yeah, I think there's a section in Bohemian Rhapsody where he goes, "Oh, baby," and you can hear that melody. Maybe just a what would be the word, Sean? Would be a pre-echo, a precursor.
I will take pre-echo. I like the sound of that.
Pre-echo, okay. And Bohemian Rhapsody. And that song, they throw everything. They throw, you know, the kitchen sink. They probably go off down to IKEA and buy a few more kitchen sinks and come back to the studio, and they throw everything at it and then turn it up to about 11 at the end. So that's Queen, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, that song is six and a half minutes almost long. Yeah. So they were setting themselves up for Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, which famously, how could you play Bohemian Rhapsody on radio at the time, because you were going to have to set aside 7, 8, 9 minutes for it, you know?
Yeah.
And that was to come. 1975 was when we would get the album and at the Opera with Bohemian Rhapsody on it. Was that the album that really established them as the world-class band that they would become and that would go on to really wow audiences at the famous Live Aid concert in 1985? They cleaned up at that one.
Ah, yeah, they absolutely did. I mean, the thing that they did is that they knew they had 20 minutes, and they went on, and the whole, if you remember, it was advertised as a global jukebox. Well, they very much took that to heart and just played hit after hit after hit. It's just a fantastic performance. And you had everybody at that, you know, Bowie and everybody, you know, U2 really arrived that day as well. But nobody could match Queen that day. Yeah. Not a chance.
Yeah. Just to finish up on the debut album then, it was a bit of a mixed bag. How was it received at the time, and when did global stardom come? I'm guessing in and around the time of A Night at the Opera.
Okay, well, how it was received at the time was with a global shrug, tumbleweeds blowing around. Nobody really gave a damn at all. But in the second album, I think, has Seven Seas Awry. And what happened there was that David Bowie had to cancel an appearance on Top of the Pops at the last minute. So an emergency phone call goes out to Queen. They turn up. They weren't crazy about the idea of miming, but Seven Seas Awry was in the top 10 the next week. So they were on their way. And then you had Sheer Heart Attack, I think, the same year, which has Killer Queen on it, another massive hit. So yeah, what you're saying, when they get to the Night at the Opera, that's when they really hit big. But they were no small potatoes before that either.
They managed to do it. Queen 2 and Sheer Heart Attack. Go ahead.
The thing about them really is you know, even Freddie dying, even that didn't stop them, you know, because there's the Queen musical that's been running for 10 years. We had the Queen movie. There's Queen approved tribute acts, and they're still out there gigging. So, and also, when you think of their greatest hits, which is the biggest selling album in UK history, 7 million. And just finish with this, Sean, even people who say they don't like Queen, you know, I think they're lying. I really do. So if you put them in a room and you give them a few Chardonnays and you stick on that Queen's Greatest Hits, just give them two minutes and you'll see how much they like Queen.
All right. And if they're still denying it right now, I'm going to finish with a little bit of Bohemian Rhapsody to hear that wonderful opening operatic sequence that we get in the opening section. Pat, thanks for celebrating the Queen debut album with us this evening.
No problem, Sean. Thank you. Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. Gilderman.
Sorry about that, Freddie, but we can't listen to all of Bohemian Rhapsody, which isn't, I know, on the debut album that we were celebrating tonight, but it seemed like a suitable way to finish up that item on celebrating the debut album, the self-titled debut album of Queen 50 years ago this week. Pat Carty helping me to celebrate that on Arena this evening. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. First up, a British R&B singer, Rita Ora, well known to many as the former judge on The Voice UK, known to others for her infamous version, shall I say, of Kate Bush's Running Up the Hill at a concert in Brazil last year. Current album, her third, is out today, called You and I. Next up, another British singer, perhaps more soulful, one could argue, Mahalia. She grew up in Leicestershire. British-Irish father, Jamaican mother, both musicians themselves. Signed her first record deal when she was just a teenager, 13, now at 25. She gives us her second full studio album, and it's entitled IRL, nothing to do with us. It's called In Real Life. And finally, American singer-songwriter Sam Burton recently signed to Uber Cred Partisan Records, where he has a new label mate. He is the new, now a label mate, rather, of Fontaine's DC, PJ Harvey and Evanessa Francis. First album on the label is out today, and it is called Dear Departed. With me in studio on this Friday evening, Brian Boyden, Zara Hederman. They've been listening to all three. We're going to start with Rita Ora. New album is called You and I. And I'm going to start with the song... What am I going to start with? I'm going to start with Praising You, featuring Fatboy Slim.
I've been gone for a minute, been low-key with my business, asking Rita, who is it? Is it true? I've been taking off every weekend, you and I and our feelings, cause the high's so much better with you.
So wish there was a camera in studio that people could have seen the faces of both Zara Hederman and Brian Boyd, as I said. And I'm going to start with Praising You from the and they just groaned when they heard that that was the song I was going to hear.
Sean,
I play.
I've already been traumatised by Bohemian Rhapsody tonight, and then you come in and you praise.
That's because I only played the opening couple of minutes of it, or just because I played it at all?
Absolutely awful. Absolutely. The thing about Rita Ora is that she's primarily. I mean, she was known in the beginning as a musician. 10 years ago, she released her debut album. She's since become one of these portfolio artists where she'll turn up as a reality TV judge. She'll act in inverted commas. She has her own tequila brand. And the Daily Mail's online site will always feature in the best washboard abs category. So she's sort of, you know, mutated from being a musician into being this sort of all-surface media personality. This album is absolute rubbish. It's one of the worst I've ever heard. I cannot believe the big single everyone's plugging this week, You Only Love Me, it's 2 minutes and 28 seconds long, okay?
2 minutes and 27 That's on my counter.
2 minutes 28 in mine, which is better. There's 7 different songwriters credited for the 2 minutes and 28 seconds. Not just that, 5 different producers. So this is the whole copy and paste thing where just, you can't have 7 different songwriters writing 2 minutes and 28 seconds. This is the thing now with these artists, that anybody could have came in and replaced Rita Ora's vocals on this, and it could have been marketed under a different name. No soul, no substance, it's rubbish.
I'm not fully clear on how Brian felt about the album, getting a sense of it. What about you, Zara? I didn't see your shoulders moving up and down.
No, actually rare for me. I do love indulging in a good little pop banger now, but Rita Ora didn't really provide that with this album. And she's someone as well, like what Brian was saying, she's done so much. And I was really surprised this week to see this is actually only her third album. And I think a huge part of that was that she was embroiled in trying to get out of Roc Nation, which she signed to when she was 18, and she really struggled to get out of that deal. And she did preface this album by saying that she spent such a long time fighting to be heard over the course of my experience in the industry, and that she lost actually quite a lot of confidence with that. And with that, she has also taken a slant of my most personal album to date with this, and it's her most diaristic album to date.
Her most what?
Diaristic. So
what does that mean?
As in like diary. Writing in her diary.
Oh, so I beg your pardon. Yes. Thank diaristic. You. I've got you now.
No, because I thought diuretic. That's Nicky, what is sorry,
I thought it was something to do with looseness of something. Yes. Yeah, let's go.
So she did say that this album's called You and I, and in the last year she has gotten married, she's found happiness, and a lot of the themes here are about love, the different guises of it, finding it, destructive love, but most crucially I think falling in love with herself. And she has it took over a decade to do that. I know.
Alright.
But she also, as Brian was saying, with all the songwriters, this is the first album that she has been the co-writer of every single song on the album too.
Let's listen to the title track, and hopefully I'm not going to traumatise both of you with this.
I used to
used to listen to the love songs on repeat, trying to figure out how they would work for me. I just wanna dance with somebody, somebody who loved me. Now I see you standing in our garden lights. Damn, who knew when I got dressed to go the night, that I finally found that somebody to stand by me.
No singing along to that one either, Brian.
You can actually see where they put that chorus onto the verse. I mean, chorus one songwriter, verse somebody else. Someone in Sweden wrote this, somebody in Los Angeles wrote that, to put it on together. This country's last 10 entries for Eurovision, which have all ended in abysmal failure, are better than the songs in this album. This album reeks of Eurovision Song Contest semi-final, going out in the semi-final. They're generic, they're glossy, and they have that sort of touch, but absolutely no substance whatsoever. Anybody, I could have gone in and sang these songs, and it would have been a better album.
How many stars are you giving us, Brian? I'm afraid to ask.
I can't, because I cannot recommend that anyone should listen to this.
It's zero. Zara?
I just think it's remarkable how she has not been able to keep up with her contemporaries, because, you know, in the pop landscape, she's not doing anything inventive. She's not really matching into, like, say, a Dua Lipa or a Billie Eilish. This is all very dated, and it's tremendous given her success. She has the record of most top 10 singles for a British female artist. This just felt so lackluster and so faceless, and for me, it's a 2.5. Because I did have some hooks in there that I did like, and I did sing along to that chorus.
I think that you might be stealing some of Brian's stars to give some to give it your 2.5. All right, I think it's fairly clear where both of you stand on that one. Let's move on to Mahalia. We've all decided on here. IRL in real life, obviously, is the abbreviation there. This is a track called, I'm going to do it with November, featuring Stormzy.
Don't wanna close my eyes for a minute, cause I miss you every time I go to sleep. And dreaming's not as good as life with you in it. So I lay awake and try not to blink. I can offer you my world. I love you even if you hurt me in your mind.
I look across the desk now. There's little love hearts all around both Sarah and Brian Boyd.
It's very white.
The love hearts are for Mahalia. They're for Stormzy. Yeah. The minute he started singing, we all said, "Wow, what?
No, I'm melted.
What? You? What? Can he? Is there anything he can't do, including sing along with? Let's realize that this is Mahalia's album that we're reviewing. What are we getting here? We're in a different world, I think it's safe to say.
We are. And as you can hear even from that song, how less is more. Yeah. And I think that's a great thing about Mahalia's album IRL. The production on this is so great. And from the offset, there's a great minimalism, I think, to it. But at the same time, she does meld in some really nice soundscapes at the start of the album with Ready, which I think is a really great opener.
Yeah. And what's she saying when she starts Ready?
So that song starts with, she said, "You thought I was finished. She thought time was up. Secretly, I did too. 2 years I've been missing." So she's talking about the follow-up to her very successful, technically studio album debut from 2020, and the pressures of kind of maintaining the momentum that was behind her. And I think that she does that in such a frank and open way, where you're with her, like you feel like she's your friend. And I think even with that song with Stormzy, it feels like, you know, you're listening to two of your friends talking about someone they fancy. And that really personal trait stays without the album, and it really, really gripped me.
And of course, I immediately wanted to know if they were an item, just because the duet is so
very
beautiful.
Very
I know, it's appalling.
We're here to judge them on their art.
Also, people can sing songs about other people and other emotions that are not their own.
That reminded me of, if you go back to the great duets of Tamla Motown, Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell,
who
did Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and a number of other love songs, and they weren't in Ireland, by the way. That reminded me of that, an updated version. It just works perfectly. But the great thing about Mahalia, the thing I really loved about her, is it's like Amy Winehouse fronting Destiny's Child. So you're getting this beautiful soul music, you're getting the beautiful R&B. But as Zara was saying, the lyrics are so, they're confessional, and they're in your face. She's one very disgruntled young woman.
But she does it without, you know, she's not barracking you with those
things.
No,
but it's a sort of substance that you're looking for in a song where obviously she's talking about her place in the music industry, how she's been sidelined. She's always talking about how R&B artists are sort of put in this category and sort of, you're urban, stay over there. And she's going, well, actually, no, we're not just urban. We're all over the music scene these days. So she's very articulate about, she's disgruntled with everything, which is a great way to go into an album because you have something to say, unlike previous albums we've heard tonight. But I love the fact that she brings out Amy Winehouse brittleness, and she's very very in your face. But in the background, you've got this pure Destiny's Child soul music going on. The mix is intoxicating for
me. Have a listen to a track called Terms and Conditions.
If you want my love, then let's discuss the man you're required to be. If you tell me lies, you get 3 strikes. There's no coming back, boy, please. If you look at her, consider bridges burned. You could call it petty, but see, if you want a position, these are my terms and conditions. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hey, hello, hi, how you doing, boy? Yeah, I'm doing fine. Said you wanna be something in my life.
Wonderful chorus out of a wonderful verse, a song called Terms and Conditions, the clean version of it, I have to say, because there are a few expletives on the album itself, but they have clean radio versions of some of the songs as well. She knows what she's at here. She had her first record deal at the age of 13. I mean, to kind of survive that and to be here at, what is she? I think she's
25.
And here she is with this second album, which is really bang, it's more than a calling card. This is difficult, in inverted commas, second album. No difficulty here at all.
Not at all. And what I think is really great as well, like, she did say how with the first album she wanted to drop the bravado that she had with that, and with this she wanted to show that vulnerability isn't a weakness. And I think we really hear that. We heard that in that last song. And I think tonally as well, I think she's done such a great job of, like, melding. There's a really nice kind of woozy reverbed guitar motif that was something that became quite popular, say, with Frank Ocean's Blonde, and has influenced so many artists. And that is a steadfast on this album. But as you heard there with Terms and Conditions, as Brian said, Destiny's Child's influences here, like the writing's on the wall. I could not but think of that. Later on, you've got like Monica and Brandy's duet comes back, and she melds the past and present very well.
Stars.
It's a 4 for me. I love this.
Very solid. I think you might have a few stars in your pockets for this one, Brian.
I'm going to make up for this one. Yeah, but I love the fact that she's not happy with her lot, and she's not afraid to express her dissatisfaction. But people sort of patting her on the head and they go, there you go, you're a very good R&B artist. We're in the presence of someone in this album who knows what they're doing, and they've a skill set to accomplish their message. Right. 4 stars also from me.
Four stars from you, Brian. Wonderful. Let us move on then to our final album this evening, Sam Burton. Let's start with a track called Long Way Round.
I took the long way around. Thought that I would have time to kill.
Sam Burton, American singer-songwriter, a second album released today, an album called Dear Departed, and there's a house divided, I think, on this particular album. Who will I go to first? Let's go to Zara first. I mentioned John Denver earlier on, the leftovers of John Denver, the leftovers of Neil Young. You also mentioned, who else did you mention?
I mentioned James Taylor.
James Taylor.
You could go for Jackson Browne, you could go for David Axelrod, Leonard Cohen, Simon Garfunkel.
The kind of bland end of all of those people. It was with, no.
Bland was your word now, Sean.
Yeah, okay. All right. What did you think of the album, Zara?
Do you know what? For all of the influences that Sam Burton has, this should have been an album that I loved.
Yeah.
And I really actually did quite like his first album, I Can Go With You, from 2020. And I think actually the Partisan signing was maybe a bit to his detriment, because they were able to give him the prospects of working with Jonathan Wilson, who is the Laurel Canyon born producer who everyone from Angel Olsen, White's Blood, Father John Misty is going to for that Laurel Canyon sound. And I think that Jonathan Wilson has maybe put too much pledge in the studio to polish these.
Okay. You were annoyed at me for Bohemian Rhapsody. You were annoyed at me for something else. Oh, yeah. What was the other one you were annoyed at me for? For choosing Rita Ora, Praising You.
The worst song in the album.
And now you're annoyed at me about this, but for a different reason, Brian.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, first of all, we've got to get, there's a great Woody Guthrie character story about to his background here. He was going out with a girl in Los Angeles. They split up. He had nowhere to live. He had no job. He went off to work on farms in North California. He's from Salt Lake City. He went off to work on farms in North California. And it was the monotony of the job that got him back into
the
writing.
The monotony
again.
Of it.
The monotony of the physical labor that got him back into it. I think the song you just played, I think it spookily reminded me of Jimmy, of Glen Campbell singing the classic Jimmy Webb song.
But isn't that
Jimmy
a problem?
Webb song. Is it? I don't know. There's another song on here which I think you might be able to play.
No, I won't, because we've got 10 seconds left.
Which is, which reminded me eerily again of So Long, Marianne. While you're talking about an artist, I'm thinking my influences. I'm going for Roy Orbison, Harry Nilsson, and Graham Parsons, which is a different.
All of which are great influences, but is there enough in Sam Burton to survive by himself? Stars from you, Brian. I need to go.
It collapses halfway through, but there's some great moments. 3.5.
3.5. Zara, sorry to rush you.
I think because we've been talking about the influences more than Sam Burton on this album, that kind of says it all. So for me, it's a 3, because it does sound nice, but there's not enough of him to draw me in.
Okay, that is Dear Departed from Sam Burton, IRL from Mahalia, and You and I from Rita Ora, Brian Boyd and Zara Hedeman, our reviewers on this Friday evening. And that is our lot for this week here on Arena. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Amadine Paso-Devine and Paula Shields were the researchers. Aisling Rufferty was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Don't forget, we're with you at the earlier time of 6:30 on Monday here on RTE Radio 1. That's for this period of the summer. Really looking forward to be with you that half hour earlier. So talk to you on Monday at 6:30. John Creedon will be with you after the news.